to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Also by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good. 'Cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat. You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. 'Cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm Chris Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Today on the show, we're going to be talking with Chris Sobroto of Sisters of the Road about that organization as well as their Healthy Plate Project.
And we'll be talking with Ryan Drum about seaweed.
But to get things kicked off, I was able to take a trip down to the Chehalem Mountains recently and talk with a few winemakers. So they were gathered in preparation of an event they put on annually called Origin. The event is coming up on August 9th, and it is where all the winemakers in the Chehalem Mountains AVA gather and serve their wine in one place. This year's site is at Arbor Brooks Vineyard. Now you might ask, what is an AVA? And this is a question I had. It's a little bit confusing, but AVA stands for American Viticultural Area, and they are set by the wineries in a specific region and the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau. So it's essentially a map, and the AVAs are delineated by specific geographic features that set them apart from other regions. That doesn't mean that all the wines from the certain AVA taste the same. All it does is it gives geographical context to the wine. So I was visiting with the Chehalem Mountains AVA, and I was able to pull a few of the winemakers aside and record a food story, as well as ask them a question about the future of winemaking in Oregon. Featured on the show today are James Fry of Tresadum Vineyards, Sheila Nicholas of Anamkara Cellars, and Todd Hansen of Leah Vineyards and Long Play Wines. We begin with their stories.
My name is James Fry. I'm the owner and winemaker at Tresadum Vineyards in Newburgh, Oregon. One of the nice things I get to do each year is Louis Jadot, which is a well-known Burgundian winery, makes wine with me here in Oregon from their Oregon vineyard. And so Jacques Lardier, well-known winemaker, spent 42 years only making wine in Burgundy. He spends his harvest now here in Oregon at Tresadum. And last year, we do every single day during harvest, we always break for lunch. Doesn't matter what people are doing. Everyone gets together. We sit down. We open a few bottles of wine, and we eat lunch together. And near the end of harvest, he's like, I want to make you guys lunch. And we're like, sure, that's great, Jacques. Do whatever you want. And he starts going over to our press and taking out Pinot Noir skins that had just been pressed. So they're, you know, they'd just made wine, they'd been pressed and they're kind of dry, and he starts taking them out. I'm like, Jacques, what are you doing with those? I'm making lunch. And lo and behold, he took the Pinot Noir skins, he got some sausage from Carlton Farms in Carlton, and potatoes, and just put it in a big cassoulet and baked it in the oven, and it was absolutely delicious. And I, you know, the seeds from the Pinot Noir berries were nutty, and it was something I would have never thought of, to actually take the Pinot Noir skins and make lunch out of them.
This is Sheila Nicholas. I'm with Annam Cara Cellars. One of my favorite and completely unforgettable courses was probably the most simple as well. We were doing a wine dinner out in a farm, and the chef had nothing but a barbecue to cook with. So he prepared for dessert, it was a lovely meal, but for dessert, he created a barbecued peach, and in the pit, he put in a scoop of homemade vanilla ice cream and then drizzled it with our dessert Gewürztraminer. And if you know Gewürztraminer, it has lovely spices. It goes beautifully with apples and pears and pumpkin pies and so on. And that, sitting out in the sun with 30 other people enjoying a barbecued peach drizzled with Gewürztraminer, surreal. I'm still thinking about it.
My name's Todd Hansen. I'm the grower at Leah's Vineyard. I sell about 80% of my fruit, but I keep a small amount just for my amusement, and I make a wine called Long Play Wine. So we're very old school. We call it analog wine for a digital world. No overdubbing, no remixing. And that means we basically try to capture the essence of the vineyard and the vintage in the bottle, because that, to me, is a perfect wine, not a wine that's been reworked and massaged so much in the cellar that it's not recognizable from where it came. So I actually went to graduate school with a year in France, and that's where I really got into wine. I took a course in French wine, and it was, they taught wine like they teach Latin, if you will, where it was wine as a dead subject. You basically studied the AOC system. You knew which grapes grew in which appellation, what the hectoliters per hectare were, the limitations and all of that. But I don't think we ever tasted a wine in that class. But I was just so intrigued by the nuance of wine, and how it's so just the slicing and dicing is razor thin. For example, in Côte du Bon or Côte de Nuit, how you have these little clos and monopoles and all of that. And so I fell in love with wine while I was in France. And then after graduation, I saw an announcement for the International Trade Administration for a position in Washington, D.C. But out of this 7-page announcement, I just read See the World. And so I sent in my resume. I was hired. And for 10 years, I basically traveled the world. I did have an assignment in West Africa, in Abidjan, in Ivory Coast. But I managed to make a couple trips down to South Africa during that period, where I just saw some stunningly beautiful vineyards. While I was in Washington, D.C., we went to Chile with work. And you're there for 3 weeks, and you're communicating, you're working sort of on negotiations and trade issues with the government of Chile, and they aren't working weekends, you know? So what do I do on my weekend? Well, I'm there for 3 weeks. Oh, gosh, I think I'll go to the Casablanca Valley and maybe visit a few vineyards. And then Italy, you know, Germany, Slovenia, you just travel around, Hungary. And that was where I sort of became a amateur, in French, you would say, or a connoisseur of wine, and started to build. We brought back 21 bottles from Italy during a visit to Italy. And then when it came time to change careers, because I just couldn't take it anymore, we had a little event on the horizon named Leah. and we decided to change jobs. And so I quit my job and bought a vineyard and named it after my daughter, Leah.
After Todd finished his story, I commented on the stark difference between his pre-winemaking life and then his current life. And he had a little bit more to say, and so I want to include that. So here's a bit of a tag to the story.
There comes a point when the rush from having your passport stamped just isn't worth it anymore. Right. You know,
you get a new rush, a slower rush.
Yeah, yeah. And for me right now, the rhythm of the seasons is my rush. Yeah. When January comes around and we start pruning, that for me is the most exciting time because that's the kickoff of the new season and things are going to start pretty soon and we're going to have bud break and we have to be ready for bud break. And we're out there spreading compost and we're out there pruning the vines and tying them to the wire, which is like the most zen thing you can do in the vineyard if you've ever done it. You cut the vine back to just two canes basically and tie them to the wire with a bread clip, a twisty, and you're looking at that vine and that vine is telling you how much can I give this year? And you look at the vine and you say, yeah, you can give that much. Or sometimes you have to actually tell the vine, no, you can't. You don't have that much in you. I want to take it easy on you. You know, the vines actually want to give. They're so generous. Mm-hmm. And they want to make the best fruit. I mean, that's what they've been raised for thousands of years to do, is to the monks in Burgundy, you know, who are growing Pinot Noir, they were selecting for the vines that would make the best fruit. And so that's what these vines want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I just have to sort of help them and actually rein in their impulses, because I don't want them to be overworked. People sometimes look at me strange, but I'll say especially with the older vines, my vineyard was planted originally in 1990 and had some newer plantings in 1999 and some really recent plantings in 2009 that I undertook. And so those older vines particularly, I swear they have a soul and they communicate with me and personalities precisely, and you know they all have their own little idiosyncrasies. And the younger vine, the baby vines as well, especially, are in that same sort of zone where they're sort of that awkward teenage years. And so what we're doing is just trying to shepherd them along as they go. They're sort of like, you know, and make the best fruit we can.
Before we move on to the question for the winemakers, I asked James to record a story I heard him telling earlier. Now, it's a story that is mostly funny if you are a winemaker, but I think there's still some humor in it. So here's the second story from James.
So another, you know, aspect of having Jacques in our winery at lunch, you know, we're always asking him questions because he's been making wine for 43 years. And last year I said, hey Jacques, what wines what vintages are drinking really well in Burgundy right now? And he says, well, I think the 04s are drinking well. I think the 11s are drinking well. And I turned to him and I said, really, the 2011s are already drinking well, because this was 2013. And he's like, oh, no, James, the 1904s, the 1911s, those are drinking well. And of course, you know, all of us in the room had only been making, you know, drinking wines from the last, you know, 10 years. To think about drinking a wine that was more than, a century old was remarkable. But he was dead serious. And he, you know, he's a firm believer in you build wines to last. And he really did feel like the 1904s and the 1911s were drinking particularly well right now.
After the winemakers told their story, I asked them a question, each the same question, which was, what does winemaking look like in 50 years? Now, I framed it as well. I asked, you know, what does it mean with the changing climates, with changing seasons? And I got three pretty different, but also quite similar answers. Of course, they are in the same region. They are facing the same conditions. Here are the answers to that question from the winemakers.
That's a great question, and I think a lot of us, when we look at climate change, you know, are concerned about what it could mean as a wine grower, as a winemaker. One of the benefits of being in Oregon or being in the Willamette Valley is we're in a cool viticultural climate, so we're already in on the margin of as cool as you can get. Quite frankly, I mean, I make Pinot Noir and Riesling at Tresadum, and I don't pick my Riesling most years until November, and I've picked as late as November 20th. So, you know, in the grand scheme of wine growing regions around the world, that's really, really late. So if it actually warms up, it probably means that I get to spend Thanksgiving with my family. And you know, obviously there's extremes to that. But because we're in a cool viticultural climate, I think we probably have a little bit more margin for error there.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I obviously don't have the answer for that. But I think what is interesting about Oregon is that every single year we are thrown a curveball. We have absolutely no idea what we're facing from the minute the bud breaks to the day we harvest. For example, last year, bud break, everything was lovely. We had a lovely warm summer, almost on track with this one, almost as warm as this one. We were looking for big wines as a result with high sugar grapes, and then it rained. And not only did it rain, but it poured for an entire weekend. I think we had about 8 inches of rain basically overnight. And that made the grapes go from 21 bricks literally down to 18, and we lost about 25% of our Chardonnay, etc. So I think that's why we all love it here, is we all live life a little bit on the edge, a lot on the edge, actually. We have no idea what's happening from one vintage to the other. So if you farmed your vineyard correctly, if you've done a good job and stayed on top of it for the other 11 months of the year, then, and you have a good site as well, that's on a good slope, various characteristics, it's on a southeast-facing slope, a good elevation, and so on, good wind, you should be in good shape, no matter what happens. Also, if you look at our history in 11, it was super cold. Super cold. You know, we harvested at really low sugar levels. We couldn't even get tomatoes ripe in 11, never mind wine grapes. So it resulted in wines that were very different from the ones that we had in 12 and 10 and 7 and so on and so forth. But again, they were just still beautiful, high acid, super elegant wines that just will last for a while. So it's a crystal ball. And we are not planning that far ahead. We are taking each year for the thrill it gives us.
My reaction has been, I like to think I'm ahead of the curve. So a lot of vineyards in this area have been planting vines. One of the biggest challenge in the Chehalem Mountains and the Willamette Valley in general, especially the North Willamette Valley, is getting ripe. We've had vintages, and this is the thing, you've got a bell curve of, you know, average vintage ripeness, and you never want to be on that underripe side. The overripe side doesn't really hurt you at all. So this led a lot of vineyards to be planted on early ripening rootstocks. And there are different cultivars, and there's different rootstocks, and some get riper earlier than others. And so I foresee that we will be planting on later ripening rootstocks, and we'll be planting later ripening cultivars. I just put in 2009 when I planted, I put in 1 3/4 acres of 828 clone, the upright clone, which is later ripening, and I put it on SO4 rootstock. It's grafted to SO4 rootstock, which is a later ripening rootstock. And so I'll have some white knuckle vintages where we're hoping it gets ripe, but when if things do continue warming up, we'll be okay and we won't have to worry. I also did put in what I call my safety school block. And that was because I had learned from some vintages that you don't always get ripe. And so I wanted something that would always get ripe. And so I put in 1 acre of 777 on Riparia Gloire rootstock, and that's always our first pick. And it's nice to get something in the cellar before the rains come. So that was the thinking there. But we can adapt is my ultimate point. We can adapt with our trellising, we can adapt with our rootstocks, we can adapt with our vine stocks, our cultivars.
Food. You are listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was James Fry of Tresadum Vineyards and Sheila Nicholas of Anamkara and Todd Hansen of Long Play Wines. To find more information about the Chehalem Mountain AVA and their event origin, you can visit the Food Show website on the KBOO website.
Next up, we'll be talking with Ryan Drum. Ryan has his Bachelor of Science in Chemical Technology and a PhD in Botany, specifically phycology, or the study of algae. He's taught botany at universities around the country, studied herbal medicine, and later taught at the Dominion Herbal College in British Columbia for 35 years. He's been an adjunct faculty at Bastyr University since 1984, and he lectures at herbal conferences and herbal schools. Ryan, welcome to the food show.
Okay, it's a real pleasure to be on the food show.
Well, today we're going to talk about seaweed. So tell us about your background and history with seaweed.
Oh my gosh. Well, it was not love at first sight. It was rather, what a messy pile of stuff in the high tide line when I used to play surfing down in Southern California. That was in 1959, and 10 years later, I was the marine botanist at UCLA teaching about seaweeds and totally enthralled with them. And having grown up in Iowa, it means that there's not a lot of seaweed action in the middle of the country. And so I had a lot of learning to do, unlike people who grow up next to the sea, such as my children, who have lived on Waldron Island, and we're just 3/4 of a mile from the sea, day and night. And what amazed me the most, Rachel, about these plants is their simplicity and their reliability. The reliability in that they carry on, they do what they have to do, and it takes a lot of disaster factors to cause them grief. And so they're fairly resilient to a lot of insults that would kill other creatures. And they also come back year after year. Most of them are annual plants, or most of their growth is annual. And so it's a very sustainable potential harvest. Ask me a question.
You talk a lot about the health benefits of seaweed, so let's hear some of the benefits we can get from eating seaweed.
Oh, yum, yum, yum. First health benefit is, of course, oral pleasure of something that's salty and changing in texture as it stays in your mouth for a while. It can be used in cooking. It can be eaten raw. And a sad truth is that most seaweeds taste terrible when they're first coming out of the water. They're all edible, but they taste terrible or not very good. And so they need to be dried or processed minimally, and then they taste great. And the single most important thing, I repeat, the single most important thing nutritionally and health-wise that we get from seaweeds regularly is iodine, dietary biosourced iodine, which we all have an absolute requirement for. No iodine, no vertebrate life. And that means that our thyroid glands have to have iodine. There is no other option. And plants, not sea plants, but other plants, seem to have no real need or interest in iodine. So it's extremely low in vegetables, for instance. And after iodine, the second most important thing from seaweeds is selenium. And those are the two elements that are very important in the thyroid metabolism of our bodies.
So after
iodine and selenium, it's potassium. And most of us are potassium deficient. I guess I'm somewhat in practice as a clinical herbalist. And I found that I would repeatedly have patients who would come in and say, oh, I can't get enough salt. I'm craving salt all the time. And then say, oh, do you mind if I eat a bunch of chips here? I just have to have some salt. And all of those people were functionally potassium deficient. And potassium tastes the same as sodium. They're both salty on the tongue. But potassium is 5 to 8 times as salty tasting as sodium. A curious thing. And we have no conservation mechanisms in our bodies for potassium. We have complicated mechanisms for retaining and protecting our sodium. And so seaweeds, compared to all land plants, that's all land plants and all animals, are relatively high, reliably, in potassium. We got to have it.
So why is seaweed compared to land plants so high in those elements? What's the reason?
Well, they're living in the soup of supply. Land plants are working all the time using water chemistry to extract minerals from the soil. It's work, relatively speaking. The seaweeds are in the growth medium, and they just pick and choose.
So if we want to harvest seaweed ourselves, is that an easy task, or is that something that takes some knowledge and skills?
A minimal amount of direction. There are some good little guidebooks which are fairly thin and comprehensive about harvesting North Pacific seaweeds, especially on the American Northwest coast and on up into BC and Alaska. And they usually have good pictures. And so with good pictures and a little description, you go out and say, so I want to harvest this, and you taste it. And some of it will taste reasonable, and others you just have to trust that once it's dried, it'll be good. And it's easy. The critical thing, Rachel, to remember is that the tides vary. And where I live here, they vary over 14 feet from the lowest low to the highest high. And so that's quite a range of growth possibilities. And the different seaweeds have sort of self-selected their isocline for depth or average depth. And so there is a kind of progression from the high tide line or top of the intertidal seaweeds, such as some nori's and sea lettuce, and then down into the medium range where there's fucus, and in the low ranges where there's irithia and kombu, wakame, and then the seaweeds which are obligatorily and preferably always submerged. And that's the grandest seaweed that grows on our coast, from my perspective, is the bullwhip kelp. And the bullwhip kelp is also, unfortunately, one of the most difficult to harvest and process because it's fragile in terms of surviving out of the ocean. It doesn't like to be in open air, and it bruises easily. Some seaweeds, like nori, seem to thrive on the, from the high intertidal, where they get a lot of sunshine on them if there's a sunny day, or pouring rain if it's a rainy day. So they're tough. That nori is resistant to solar damage, resistant to freshwater attack, whereas the bullwhip kelp practically self-destroys if it gets a little bit of sun or out of the water for very much time. And the other thing to remember is that all seaweeds, when they're in the seawater, are being cooled. They're being cooled. And that means they can be as hot metabolically as they choose. And then once you get them out of that cold water and into a bucket or a 48-quart picnic cooler, they start getting hot because of their own high metabolic rate. And so seaweeds can, in a modest way, cook themselves in a couple of hours or less if you don't have them in a little bit of cold seawater with the lid off, because they all have, I know it sounds crazy, but they all have a high oxygen / fresh air requirement. And out there in the wave action, you're getting lots of aeration, usually most of the time, especially when the tide's coming in or waves are breaking on the shore. That's a high-action place. And so it's easy, when we think of our own comfort, to assume that the seaweeds would also like to be out of all that rush and cold water and in a nice container of some kind. It ain't true.
And then if you want to process it somehow afterwards, is there much of a process to go through?
Yes, it's called bother. And the least bother is to just freeze it. Freeze your seaweeds and thaw them as needed. Seaweeds dry down between 5 and 20 to 1. And so there's a great shrinkage in volume if you dry them. And we dry ours just here in the cabin, hanging from nails. We counted one day, and we had some around 784 nails, 20 box bite nails, that we hang our seaweeds from. And that's all the seaweeds except nori. And the nori we lay out on big racks and dry. We keep no fresh seaweeds here in our lives. We do occasionally pickle the stalks, the bullwhip kelp, and rarely we tried pickling some kombu, the big, almost like felt leather brown seaweed. And we find that drying works for keeping as long as we can keep it airtight and dry. If the seaweeds in storage get a little damp, they tend to develop off flavors and their color fades, and pretty soon you wonder if a garden can stand them as compost. Another interesting thing to consider is that almost all the seaweeds that you can see, those are the macrophytes or large plants, have animals, trace animals, growing on them and occasionally in them. And when those animals suffocate because you put the lid on your bucket, or they got too hot and died because the seaweed was warming up, or they just died because you're drying the seaweed, you don't notice them unless they're hard shell snails. Then you notice those the worst possible time when you're serving a special seaweed to somebody for dinner and didn't get all the snails out. But the hazard I'm leading up to is that those animals will putrefy when they are rehydrated or when they are re-wet very much, unless they're cooked immediately. And so one of the things I remember when I first went to teach at Western in Bellingham in 1970 was that the food co-op there had the worst smelling seaweed I'd ever imagined. Ah, awful. And what had happened is that the bin would get a little low, something like bladder wrack or kelp, and then they would just top it up with fresh stuff. And so the stuff in the bottom got a little damp over time, and the animals would putrefy. Oh, and so seaweed's got a kind of a bad reputation because of the smell of dead animal tissue. Forgive me.
Well, that's good to know.
And let me just run a little bit further on that. Several of the large leaved seaweeds, such as essentially all the kelps, irisia, not short-lived ones like nori and sea lettuce, but the large ones at certain times of summer will get white plaque growth on them, and these plaques are one or two cell layers thick of calcium carbonate corals, northern short-lived corals, 3 to 6 weeks. And those seaweeds then can be especially susceptible to rehydrating a little bit and then having the coral animal bodies decay. However, that calcium carbonate is allegedly one of the most healthful sources of calcium that we can have in our diets. And so we dry some of those deliberately, keep them really dry, and powder them. And so the easiest way for us, and my household, which is variously my 3 kids, 2 grandkids, and partner, we eat an average of about 10 pounds of dried seaweed a year per person. And at a 10-to-1 dry down, that's about 100 pounds fresh, or what, at least a quarter pound of fresh seaweed equivalent every day. And we've noticed no ill effects except continuing good health.
So
children never went to the doctor, and so they get a sports physical in high school. Could just be a coincidence, I'm sure. But we like to attribute the seaweeds with maintaining our health.
Well, let's talk about the issues associated with Fukushima. You don't seem to be worried about radiation issues.
Oh, well, let's divide that into 2 sections. Fukushima, I might start worrying about pretty soon. The actual oceanographic hydrologists who are following the movements of the currents in the Pacific calculated. This was published in Beachcomber's Alert, Curtis Evermeyer's marvelous little kind of home-published newsletter, comes out several times a year, that we probably wouldn't see the actual atoms that were extruded from the Fukushima disaster into the water until about the spring at the earliest of this year, 2014. Unlike the gaseous emissions when one or more of the facilities there exploded and spewed clouds of radioactive debris up into the jet stream. And we got that within 3 to 5 days and an enormous spike of radioactive elements, primarily iodine-131, cesium-137, strontium-90. The iodine-131 is completely decayed to xenon-54, and some energy, and I think an alpha or beta particle, after 8 to 10 weeks because of its very short 8-day half-life. The strontium and cesium each have about 30-year half-lives, so we'll have them around for about another 250 years, and in our bodies as well. And so the mountains along the west coast of the American continent serve as condensation pinnacles that trap those clouds for a while, and that made sure that we got lots of radioactive rain in the week to 10 days after Fukushima. But since, there's been some headline hysteria associated with floating objects, which then sail across, and that can take anywhere from a few months. Those of you who have tried to sail from Hawaii, for instance, to Washington or San Francisco know that the currents are extremely tricky. It's not a straight line flow from the west to the east. And so we may not see very much of that water at all. I believe for your listening audience in the greater Portland area, that hazard is Hanford Nuclear Reservation, where early safeguards were minimal or unknown, and the lifespan of the hazard was also unknown. And so where are we now? 60 years after that started being heavily contaminated, 60 years or more. And the cleanup is still just in its infancy. And so I see that as a potential nuclear disaster because we don't know how long those things will be stable or safe. And Portland is downstream from that. And the other hazard, at least from my perspective as a biologist, is the Willamette River water. And then, on and on and on. So there are all kinds of other hazards. However, wherever there are nuclear facilities, that is a disaster in waiting. And I would say unless they're dismantled carefully and thoughtfully, that's close to 100%.
So does the radiation increase does it affect the seaweed at all?
Thank you. Great question. Apparently not. And it's difficult to safely conduct research, but the unicellular algae, the wee ones, can concentrate radioactive isotopes up to 100 and some up to 1,000 times the concentration of those radioactive isotopes in the ambient water with no apparent damage or loss of reproductive capacity. And in terms of the larger seaweeds, I have not seen research papers or experimental papers where seaweeds are burned radioactively and then what is their recovery rate. And I think one of their strong points is that they are a modestly differentiated set of organisms in that they have a few tissue types or cell types and lots of them. And what I've noticed from mechanical heat and regular poisons, not radioactive poisons, is that there can be fairly large damaged areas and including dead areas in a seaweed body. And it just grows either around it or away from it. And the dead parts are sloughed off, much as we slough off our entire epidermis every 30 days or so as dandruff. And I would like to see some experiments long-term on large seaweeds such as bull kelp or kombu, sugar wrack, which grows so well on our coast commercially. I don't know if anybody growing bullwhip kelp commercially, but the large sugar wrack would be an ideal subject. It grows quickly, it's enthusiastic about life, and just see how much can we irradiate it. But I think that would be a difficult experiment to set up safely, mostly for the investigators rather than the seaweed. So, good question. I don't think the work has been done. And the seaweed that would be the least affected, the one which is the most cultivated for human consumption, is nori. And it grows very quickly, and so there's not much opportunity for bioaccumulation. Did that answer in part what you asked me?
Yeah, yeah. That gets us...
There are some parts which are just going to be total unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm blessed to have a subscription to the Wall Street Journal. Not a plug, but a thank you. They regularly have in-depth and fairly lucid articles about not just Fukushima, but Hanford as well, and other nuclear, we can call them disasters, but just little minor slips and leaks and stuff getting away. And those are not reported publicly often for national security reasons. And so there may be a lot of small nuclear facility failures going on that we are not allowed to know about.
Okay. Well, Ryan, we're getting close to the end of the interview, so to wrap it up, do you want to tell us about your favorite ways to, or one of your favorite ways to consume seaweed?
Oh, yes. To eat it.
Yes.
And you laugh. However, we all feed transdermally, and my family and I and my students and helpers over the years have taken a lot of seaweed baths. And that's when, especially after a storm, a lot of seaweed has been ripped off the rocks and shore area. That's a small thing. All seaweeds that, with all exceptions that we get here, are land plants. They're seawater-tolerant land plants. They do not live out at sea, away from land. And so they wash up occasionally after it's ripped out at low-tide storms. We gather it up, put it in our outdoor cast-iron tub, put a fire underneath that tub, and we cook ourselves at about 105 degrees or so in a seaweed bath. And we feel that we absorb a lot of great stuff. And then we go up, and the fire's going. We don't have electricity, of course. And we make bread, and then we make toast, and we cover that toast with fresh, yummy organic olive oil. And then we put about a half a teaspoon of powdered bullwhip kelp on there, spread it out, and just luxuriate in pure, yummy health. Mm. And while we're doing that, we've got some home-dried nori pieces, and we put those either in a dry cast iron skillet and cook them until they stop moving. And even though they're supposed to be totally dry, they're not. There's still a few percentage of moisture in there, and as they dry, they shrink and expand differentially, and they dance around the bottom of the pan. When they stop dancing, we pick them out, drop the pan, and just start chewing on one of the most wonderful things humans can eat. Fresh, toasted, untreated with any funny chemicals, namely hot sauce or cinnamon or ginger or something. Local nori.
Fabulous. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on the food show today. Once again, we are talking with Ryan Drum, herbalist and seaweed extraordinaire with his Bachelor of Science in Chemical Technology and PhD in Phycology. Thanks again, Ryan.
Thank you. It's been a great treat. Take care.
So we're going to leave the coast and head to Old Town in Chinatown in Portland, where there is a concentration of homelessness and poverty. There's also an organization, Sisters of the Road, that is working to combat that homelessness and poverty. We have Chris Sobroto, cafe co-manager and development co-manager at Sisters of the Road, on the phone to tell us about that organization and some of their projects. Chris, welcome to the food show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So could you give us a brief history of Sisters of the Road?
Yes, absolutely. So like you said, we've been in Old Town almost 35 years now, And many of the customers that come to the cafe are experiencing homelessness and poverty. And from the beginning, we've had a pretty radical model. A meal is $1.50. That's been the price all along. It's the best deal in town. And folks can pay with cash. People can use their SNAP benefits, and it's one of the only places in the country, I believe, where people can use their SNAP benefits for hot prepared food, which is really amazing. And the third way that folks pay for their meal is through work trade, through barter. So probably about 60% of the people who come and eat in the cafe help us run the cafe. They're either bussing tables, plating food, bringing out drinks, bathroom host, and for half hour of work that people are helping us, we pay them in these punch cards. So half hour work is worth $3 in a punch card. And these punch cards, all these years, they've been able to use them to purchase meals for themselves, to share with friends. And sometimes people collect so many punch cards that they'll host meals for all 200-something people for the whole day. So there's a real sort of community healing. And we introduced a new project with these punch cards this summer called Healthy Plate Project. And that's where folks earn the punch cards in the cafe as usual and are able to shop at 7 Portland farmers markets with a $15 a day limit. So if you do the math, people can increase their weekly grocery budget by about $105 a week, which is a huge impact on folks who are experiencing a lot of food insecurity.
So they can use those right now at the Portland farmers markets and I'm assuming the satellite Portland farmers markets?
Yeah, there's 7 different markets that are running right now that are under the Portland Farmers Market umbrella, and they're our partners in this. New Seasons Market put up the initial funding. It was a pilot project. We really didn't know if it was going to be successful, how it was going to go. We did a lot of field trips where we provided bus tickets and tote bags and walked around with folks and really, you know, tasted things, did all those samples that were everybody loves at farmers market, talked to vendors, got folks really comfortable, and word really spread. And stunning success. In the first 8 weeks, our customers spent $4,500 at Portland Farmers Market. So over 300 people probably visited. And it's just thinking about the impact for our community, just that kind of purchasing power, and the recipients, the farmers and vendors, that punch of funding right to the people who are growing the food and producing the food is pretty stunning.
It definitely seems like a win-win. The people get food that they need, and then the farmers get, you know, an income as a result.
Absolutely.
So I was wondering, you know, you mentioned that Sisters has been around for 35 years, so since 1979. Why do you think Sisters of the Road has been able to persist and build community for so long?
To be honest, that's our foundation. That's who we are. Community is sort of one of our roots, and what that means for us is it's not just about having a meal and calling it good and going to the next person. It's about creating a space where people come in. You know, we have a reservation system, and what that allows is instead of folks standing in line all day, they can come in, let us know what time they want to eat, take care of all the things they need taken care of. And when they come in, they can sit down with their friends, order at the counter, wait it on. So it's really about taking that time and creating that space where people are building relationships. And I think that's the richness of Sisters, and that's absolutely who we are. And we're able to be that way because we take the time. And, you know, we had a very interesting transition about 4.5 years ago. It was before the reservation system. We served 400 people a day. There was a line out the door. It was a very intense environment. And we decided to go to this reservation system. Very difficult choice because it meant we were serving 250 people a day. But what that allowed us to do is that for the folks who could come, it was a safe environment, a relaxing environment. People could really just sit down, take a breath, enjoy their meal, and really and choice that felt really important to us.
It seems like most shelters and kitchens serving the homeless try to feed as many people as cheaply as possible. What is Sisters of the Road's approach to feeding people?
Yeah, you know, we realize that for a lot of folks in our community, this is probably one of their main meals of the day, and realize that it was more important than anything that this meal is loaded with fresh local produce and fruits. And so we created a sort of a sourcing program where we went directly to farmers and ranchers and spoke with them, and also our donors. There was a lot of educating people to let them know that healthy food is every person's right, and especially folks who are struggling in the system. And so we really definitely wanted to prioritize that and have been able to do that.
So I manage the St. John's Farmers Market, and FoodWorks is one of our vendors.
Oh, yeah.
And we love them. They're fantastic. Just to give a little bit of background, FoodWorks is this, it's a farm out on Savi Island that youth work on, and then they get to sell the produce at markets around the city. But they also have a partnership with you, and I wanted to hear a little bit about that.
You know, that is a really, really special partnership. How it began initially was we wanted to get more fresh food. We have a few different, we have the sourcing directly from farmers, ranchers, Beeline Sustainable Urban Delivery. They're a bike company that does deliveries of, you know, bike parts, food, office supplies all over the city. And they go to Whole Foods to do a delivery, and every day they also pick up stuff that Whole Foods has gleaned from their shelves. So you can imagine it's really amazing quality produce, and we get first pick. And that helps us get through the year all this amazing fresh fruits, organic fresh fruits and vegetables that have just been pulled from Whole Foods shelves. But we were realizing that in the summer there's so much bounty, and we really wanted to be able to access some of that even more. And we're really, as a nonprofit, we're always asking for donations. So instead of doing that, we asked New Seasons to pay FoodWorks directly the cost of a season-long CSA. So they agreed to that, and FoodWorks delivers, I don't know, probably 60 pounds of food a week, just the most incredible organic produce. That alone is like an incredible part of the partnership. But what we also realized is there was an opportunity for both of our communities to see a little bit more of the food cycle. So what we've done is we bring Sisters community and staff and volunteers, board members out to the farm times a year. And when we're out there, we are weeding, we're planting, we're harvesting. And it's just amazing to get out to Savi Island with our folks. And the youth, when we're out there, are amazing leaders and teachers and show us how to do everything. And then once a week, the youth come into the cafe and volunteer in the cafe and help us, you know, do the busing, wait staff, steam table, you know, all the different chores that we need help with. So it's been a really incredible partnership where our customers are seeing where the food comes from. You know, one day they'll go out there and harvest it, and it'll be in the cafe the next day on our plates. And also for the youth to see all this work they've put into the food, to nourishing folks who really need it. So it's been pretty amazing. We're in our third year, and people get pretty excited about being able to go out to the farm every year.
Great. So we were talking a bit about some of the, you know, your projects and the ways that you're able to serve the homeless and you know, people who are living in poverty. I'm curious, one of the missions of Sisters of the Road, and it's definitely a very radical mission, is to address the systemic issues of homelessness and poverty. And so I'm just wondering, how does Sisters of the Road address those issues?
You know, we've addressed it in different ways over the years, for sure. We have had community organizers, done work with fair right housing. What it's looked like at Sisters is really our food justice work. And at Sisters, that's about food access and food equity. And so, you know, it's wonderful that when people come to the cafe, we have great food and can serve them fresh, amazing, nutritious food. But then what happens when our doors are closed on the weekends or in the evening? And so the Sweet Plate Project, the partnership with the Portland Farmers Market, that for us is really kind of building just where people can access healthy food all the time. And so that's what our work is looking at and looking like now. It's sort of creating our values and our community that is really thriving at Sisters, and partnering with other organizations to kind of make that reach a little further.
So it sounds like you really love your job and you love the work that you're doing. I'm wondering, what is your favorite part of working at Sisters of the Road?
You know, one part of my job is I often get to open up the doors in the morning at 7 o'clock and start cooking for the day. So we have 7 and 10 to get everything ready. And we probably have about 4 or 5 volunteers who are waiting at the door for us to open, who come in and help. And I love working side by side with folks and relying on people. We have Robert is a dear friend of mine and volunteer who on baking, and he'll just go in and create treats and desserts. And I really love the feeling that I'm relying on folks, they're relying on me, we're all in it together, and we get to make some amazing food. So it's probably the special piece.
So we're running out of time, unfortunately, but I want to give you an opportunity now to tell our listeners how they can engage with Sisters of the Road.
Absolutely. You know, this is, as I said, our funding for the program ran out in 8 weeks. We had no idea that was going to happen, and we have found funding to move it further, but Healthy Plate Project has been a huge success. And our customers are really counting on it, and I wanna be able to continue it throughout the year. So right now, through the end of the month, through July 31st, all donations are matched dollar for dollar. So it's a really great time for folks to engage and support a project that is just having a really huge impact. And I'd love for folks to come down to the cafe and have lunch. You know, you can either use the reservation system or you can call and see if I'm around, and I'd love to have lunch with you, because it's until you walk into the cafe and see all the smiles and the hugs, it's really one of a kind, and I think that kind of changes all of us in a really profound way, and I'd love people to experience that.
And it sounds like there's an event coming up that Sisters is involved with? Is it the jazz festival or a jazz show? I'm sorry, maybe I got my information wrong.
That might have gone by. I'm wondering if you think, I mean, in September we have a really huge event, Dining with Dignity, and that's really great. We have restaurants all over the city who donate a percent of proceeds for any given day in the month of September to Sisters. So definitely to eat out all through September, and you know you'll be making a difference. And the Culinary School at the Art Institute does a really amazing benefit event. Chef Corey Schreiber and his students will be cooking up some really great food. So definitely buy tickets to that event. All the 100% proceeds go to Sisters, and that will be on September 16th. So that's some great stuff. And then in November 7th, we'll be celebrating our 35th birthday, and that's going to be pretty special.
Great. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining us on The Food Show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Chris Sobrotto from Sisters of the Road. That's it for this episode of The Food Show. Thank you to our guests, Ryan Drum, James Fry, Sheila Nicholas, Todd Hansen, and Chris Sobrotto. Also, a big thanks, as always, to our board operator, Tammy. You can hear us again on the third Wednesday of August for another installment of The Food Show, and you can also find past episodes of The Food Show on the KBOO website. Stay tuned for some jazz here on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Bennett.
Thanks for listening.
Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food, working those lands for too hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly, need some drink for the dying their throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly, need some drink for the dying their throat, need
tops off, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. 'Cause people need food in their belly, they need some drink for the dry.
It's just noon. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. That wraps up the public affairs programming for this morning. Stay tuned for Jazz. Jazz Lives is coming up next after the noon news headlines.
This is KBOO Headline News for Wednesday, July 16, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Baker Sanitary Service has asked the Baker County Planning Commission to allow the company to accept waste from Grant and Wallola counties. The company currently buries trash from Baker and Union counties at its landfill near Sutton Creek, about 3 miles southeast of Baker City.
Portland is the only city outside of California to be recognized in a list of the top 5 cities in clean technology innovations. While Portland is considered a leading clean tech innovator, the 2014 Clean Edge report confirms that a lot of other communities across the U.S. are making inroads as well.
In national news, two California companies, Clorox and Ultraviolet Devices, have partnered to produce and sell UV machines for ultraviolet disinfection of hospitals and other healthcare facilities. The machines can kill even the hardiest of bacteria. The CDC has estimated that as many as 23,000 Americans die each year.